through to Dennis McNamara, made in New York City. On February 16th, 1998, the interviewer is Sutherland.
That's it. Okay. Well, first I want to thank you, Mr. McNamara, on behalf of Yale, for participating in this UN oral history program. And I would like first to ask you if you would tell me something about your background, how you were selected to be chief of the human rights component in Cambodia.
Right, well, I had been, since 1975, I'd been with UN, the UN High Commissioner for Refugees Office, mainly on the protection legal side, and a lot of that time on Southeast Asia, Indochina issues. And in fact, 1990, I was on secondment from UNHCR to the Special Representative for Humanitarian Assistance to the Kampuchean People, which was then Mr. Kibria at ESCAP. And it was during that time as his deputy that the Paris Accords were signed. And we met Mr. Akashi, I think, on one of his first visits to Cambodia after that signing. And from there, unbeknownst to me, he then put my name forward for the human rights component for UNTAG. In fact, I learnt about it from a press statement carried in the Bangkok press that we had been named. So it was out of that process that it happened.
Just as an aside, had you known Rafi Ahmed when he was involved in the negotiation process out of Bangkok?
Yes. In fact, we liaised. Rafi Ahmed's office in New York was our liaison office for our fundraising and other activities on behalf of humanitarian assistance to Cambodia, both the border and inside. And yes, I'd known Mr. Ahmed, I suppose, off and on for some 15 years or something like that prior to this time.
But you were not involved in what he was doing and traveling between Indonesia, Thailand, and later to Cambodia itself?
Not in the negotiations. I was very much on the humanitarian assistance side.
Right. Mm-hmm. Well, let me go right straight ahead. You said that it was Mr. Akashi who chose you, more or less. Could you talk a little bit about how your job fitted into the picture in Cambodia, if you arrived there, relations with Mr. Akashi, first of all, with the special representative?
Well, we didn't know each other at all, so it was starting from zero in that sense. And I always remember the first days most of the directors of the components of UNTAG flew in with Mr. Akashi in mid-March 1992. Almost all of us landed together to really a totally unprepared situation. Although there had been a previous UN presence, as you know, in Cambodia, preparing. That's right.
Let me just interrupt. Have they done anything in the human rights field at all?
No, nothing at all. And the only thing that had happened in the human rights field, and this maybe have something that triggered off of Mr. Akashi's mind, we had, when I was with Kibria's Office for Humanitarian Assistance, we had responsibility for Umbro and the border camps in Thailand. And I initiated in those camps, because of my special interest, I suppose, human rights training programs in the camps as part of the Umbro activities in the last month's year of those camps. And that was the only so-called human rights activity that had ever been undertaken by the UN for Cambodians at that time. And in fact, just to jump, we took a lot of the materials which had been worked on by the team we had funded there, putting them into Khmer, into audiovisual form. We used a lot of those materials, in fact, subsequently for the human rights education program inside the country. Mm-hmm. So we had something of a preparatory phase in that sense, but not with UNAMIR. No, not at all.
I see.
And as to how it fitted, I remember also those very early discussions very well with Mr. Akashi and the other colleagues. There was no forward planning, I think, particularly in the human rights area. I remember discussing with him, asking him how he saw the human rights operation. He basically said, well, why don't you make some suggestions and let me look at them, which I did. And I wrote a first memo out of the blue, as it were, suggesting that we should do monitoring and education and training and a whole range of things. But essentially he had no problem with that, and that became the sort of basic blueprint. So we started from zero, really, on the whole thing. And I don't think, to be fair, that any of the other directors or heads of the components of UNTAC had any preconceived notions at all, or experience for that matter, mm-hmm. on human rights programs of this nature. Mm-hmm.
So going back to the relationship with the Yasushi Akashi, mm-hmm. In some of the literature it suggests that there were differences between you or your component and him as to the intensity of the efforts in behalf of human rights. How would you comment on that?
Well, I think that's true, and I think he would probably agree with that as well. you had a special representative appointed with a very broad trusteeship-type mandate to get a peace in place and to hold free and fair elections. And in the middle of all that, which was the overwhelming thrust of UNTAC, as you know, mm-hmm. free and fair elections were the goal. Somehow this difficult human rights activity had to be fitted in to meet the aspirations, I suppose, of the signers of the Paris Agreement. I'm not sure it was the aspirations of the Cambodian factions, but certainly of the sponsors of the Paris Accord. And fitting in human rights into that is always a difficult process because it's a disruptive factor. At the same time, we had, as you know, to be able to have the international community certify that there was an environment conducive to a free and fair election. And that meant certain basic rights at a minimum had to be respected, which they were not and had not been historically in Cambodia at any time, not just through Khmer Rouge time, but in history. So yes, there were certainly tensions. I think there was a lack of understanding of human rights. Myself and my colleagues at Isolated for the Moment were inclined to be more human rights activists. Obviously, that was what we saw our role as being. At the same time, we had to fit into a very difficult and sensitive political operation and turn to a peacekeeping operation, which did not succeed in peacekeeping because, as you know, we failed to disarm the factions and we had the Khmer Rouge pull out. So we had to somehow juggle all this in the middle of that complex equation. And certainly there were tensions and I think probably a lack of consensus as to the best approach in some respects.
Did you feel that the mandate that emerged from the Paris agreements was adequate in the human rights area?
Well, I think it was probably the most intrusive mandate that has ever been entrusted to a peacekeeping and maybe that will ever be entrusted to a peacekeeping operation, including in the human rights area. Mm-hmm. Not only did Akashi have the authority, as you know, to remove officials and to pass laws, we had a pretty wide mandate to take all necessary action to try and obtain this neutral political environment that was called for the elections. And to draft laws and to promulgate laws, which we did, to help draft the Constitution, which we didn't do very well. So I think the authority was certainly wide enough from the Accords, yes.
And tell me about your chain of command. Akashi obviously was the head man in Cambodia, but were you receiving guidance or directions for that matter, either from Geneva or from New York on human rights enforcement?
No. Geneva had really no role. The Center for Human Rights really had no role at all. Mm-hmm. A pity I felt. We looked to them for materials, for example, but the materials they had on human rights education were quite inappropriate for the semi-literate peasants of Cambodia that we were having to spread the message with. So we had to develop all our own materials, and we got no input and had no links with the Center for Human Rights in Geneva, which
I see.
I think in parentheses is something in the lessons we could come back to as a problem in a way, but no links at all. Virtually, I did report to the Subcommission on Human Rights sessions in Geneva, but that was my own initiative. I went and did address the subcommission. Mm-hmm. I went to the World Conference on Human Rights in Vienna, also actually made a presentation there. But that was really our own initiative. Mm-hmm. New York also, we reported through Akashi. Mm-hmm. We had no separate line on human rights reporting, except, of course, the Undersecretary Generals Kofi Annan then and Mick Goulding, who came out. We certainly had contact with them either in Phnom Penh or in New York, but that was by dint of the fact that we were there or they were there. But the reporting line was through the special representative.
And they were there for the peacekeeping operation.
They were there primarily for the peacekeeping operation.
Right.
Yes, the Secretary General also visited on two occasions, and so we had a chance to brief on those occasions.
Yeah, did I was going to come back to that, but Mr. Boutros Ghali did come there twice.
Yes.
He did have certain ideas about the election, I think, of
yes.
the government. Did he show any particular interest in your operation? Was there?
No, I would say that his overwhelming message was, we've got to have these elections and get out. That was the message. It was from the Permanent Five, or the expanded EP5, as it was called. I think nine of them, in fact. It was from Prince Sihanouk, loud and clear, and it was from the Secretary General.
Mm-hmm.
This was a $2 billion expensive operation, and you had to have those elections and go, was the message.
Right, right, right. Well, then, clearly then, you were almost self-contained in Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
Did you feel quite independent then in leading your component in its work?
Independent to the point of sometimes being unsupported, I would say. Yes, and I took independent action. A lot and a number of initiatives in the human rights area, which I had been used to doing, I suppose, from my UNHCR background as well, where we tend to deal with human rights issues with authorities in a different way. And so did the team of mainly lawyers and human rights people that I'd recruited. So we were independent until we bumped up against the political peacekeeping sensitivities, which was a fairly regular occurrence. Either with the special representative, his deputy, or the heads of the components, and particularly, I would say, the military component.
Well, that was my next question, because there were seven components, I think, altogether. And was there friction among those components? Mr. Akashi indicated he had greatest difficulty with the judiciary, with the legal component, actually. And I wondered how you fitted into all of this. Was there a...
The legal component would have been the legal advisors in his office, in fact, I suppose.
Right, that's right.
But he certainly had difficulty with the human rights component as well, even if he did, wasn't so blunt about it. Yes, I think, one of the lessons that I think we tried to draw out of this, and which certainly I felt very strongly, was if human rights is going to have a role, and call it what you like, but if you're going to have free and fair elections and a neutral political environment, it's about human rights in the broad sense, then there's a very great need for at least the heads of the components and the heads of the missions to have a basic understanding of what the human rights framework entailed. And I'm afraid that was not the case, including, of course, the senior military and police officials, most of whom had not been in any such peacekeeping or UN operation previously. And that was a difficult area. Some of the police officials had experience in Namibia and elsewhere, and we worked and had to work very closely with them. Human rights investigations depend on their cooperation. And I'd say that was not without difficulty, but was easier than with the military, most of whom had an inherent resistance to the human rights issues and approaches, and felt that these are really quite disruptive activities, and we didn't get a lot of support on key issues.
Did you have much direct contact with General Sanderson himself?
Yes, yes. In fact, I think the seven directors and Akashi and his deputy, Sadri, we probably met just about every morning or 6 days a week for a year and a half around the same table. So we had very close contact on a daily basis.
Now, I have a very broad question, but could you just describe a little bit, how did you go about this task of trying to implant a respect for human rights in Cambodia? How did it work?
Well, it worked at different levels. I'd say the first preoccupation was to monitor abuses, which were essentially the attacks on the political opposition, mainly by Hun Sen and his forces, against Phun Simpek Ranarit's political party, which was the main threat. But not only, there were also other factions involved, and of course the Khmer Rouge, who disassociated themselves from the whole process, were really outside this equation. But so our first concern was monitoring abuses, either political abuses or abuse of the Vietnamese minority, especially by the Khmer Rouge, and reporting on that and trying to take action on that. That was a sort of sharp edge, I would say. Then we had a number of other different aspects. Police judicial training was a major area of undertaking, building up local NGO capacity, supporting Cambodian NGOs on human rights, training, briefing, supporting, and trying to advise. And then a major human rights education and training program, both in institutions such as the law schools, medical school, etc., at one level, but most importantly, I would say, almost the audiovisual simple means of mass communication throughout the countryside, using puppet shows, descriptive diagrams, radio, UNTAG, mobile video units, to try and spread the message that people had basic rights. They included the right, obviously, to vote in an election, but they also included the right not to be arbitrarily beaten or detained by the police, and that officials had to be held accountable, and that people should try and make sure that that process happened. And we did the two in tandem. We did, for example, prison visits where we demanded and had the removal of shackles from prisoners. At the same time, we tried to train the police that they should not and could not shackle prisoners. At the same time, we tried to tell the population they didn't need to be shackled. So it was a multi-leveled approach, basically.
And where did you find the staff to do that?
Well, I recruited them. We recruited them. I started with one or two colleagues, mainly from the border program that I mentioned to you at the start. And then we had to find the people. And we finally, after a painful process through UN headquarters, which is famously slow to move and field operations and not really equipped to do so in any expedited way, I think it was 6 months probably before we had our 40-odd professionals in place. But eventually I did have a team in Phnom Penh, and I had one or more international professionals in each of the 20-odd provinces of Cambodia.
And how many, or what proportion of those did actually come from headquarters in New York? I mean, were there many?
No, very few. Very few. Offhand, I can't think in the human rights component that there was anybody, perhaps one or two at most, out of UN headquarters. No, we had to find them from various operations, because it was a rather special area, and so we did a search and found people also who had regional knowledge.
Well, that's the next question. How was the staff fairly Asian?
No, it wasn't very Asian.
No.
There's not many Asian human rights activist operational people, I'm afraid, who, at least they weren't available then for that sort of operation. I had a very valuable Burmese assistant, a grandson of U Thant, in fact, and that, and some other Indian and other colleagues whose perspective was valuable. But no, we had a shortage of that. I would say, as often seems to be the case, we tended to be rather Western in our composition. But we were very anxious to have that regional perspective, and we did put together and funded a consortium of Asian NGOs from outside Cambodia to come in and support the Cambodian NGOs from Sri Lanka, from India, from the region, from Thailand, so that they could keep it in that regional context.
I want to come back to the NGOs in a minute, but meanwhile, another broad question. How would you describe the main problems that you faced in carrying out this program?
Well, I mean, we were operating in a semi-destroyed state, I would say, where accountability and rule of law was not historically a factor. It wasn't just Mr. Hun Sen and the Khmer Rouge who didn't have any accountability or notions of rule of law. It was also traditionally the case with Sihanouk and Lon Nol and all of the regimes prior to them. So the concept of accountability, rule of law, due process, the concept of questioning authority was not one familiar really to the Cambodian culture in general. It was very much an oppressed, semi-literate, rural, impoverished rural society with fairly authoritarian rule, leadership, and the most extreme form of which was obviously the Khmer Rouge, but was not the only form that they'd been used to at all. So we started from way back in terms of trying to create what was supposed to be a neutral political environment with basic rights for the citizenship assured. A mammoth undertaking. In a year and a half with 40 professionals and sure the backing of 20,000 peacekeeping troops and police, but not something that you can accomplish in that period in any meaningful and lasting way, I'm afraid.
And did you find among the Cambodians that there was fear of the Hun Sen, of the Sokh, so to speak? Or
yes.
Were they afraid? How did they view you? As intruders?
The Sokh authorities?
Mm-hmm. No, the Sokh authorities, but also the Cambodians that you were dealing with in the field.
Well, the population generally was intimidated.
They were intimidated.
Intimidated, I'd say, destabilized and traumatized. Mm-hmm. I remember, of course, they'd been through one of the auto-genocides or massive atrocities of the century. Destabilized, distrustful, factionalized, and very intimidated by authority. Mm-hmm. Yes, absolutely. And in fact, without any meaningful judicial or police process except a process to uphold the authority of the central government, not a process to respect or protect the basic rights of the citizens at all. And as I say, no accountability. The military or political elimination of opposition members was a regular practice without any real accountability, which led us, maybe you know, to the extreme, I think first time ever measure of setting up our own prosecutor's office, building a prison, and actually arresting three perpetrators of gross violations because there was no other way to try and get a message through that this couldn't go without any repercussions.
Yeah, the appointment of the prosecutor came fairly late in the game, right?
Yes.
And this gets a little bit ahead, but what...
When the political violence got so great that we couldn't tolerate
it. And Akashi took that decision to appoint him on his own, right?
Well, no, after a lot of discussion, at our suggestion, our strong urging, it was rather hesitatingly taken by the leadership of UNTAG, but it was certainly resisted also by some members of that leadership.
And was it effective? You say three people were, in the end, arrested by the CIVPOL. Who actually arrested?
Yes, by CIVPOL military and put into an UNTAG-built detention facility.
Mm-hmm.
We think it had an enormous deterrent value, and that's all it was intended to have. We obviously couldn't substitute for a failed judicial police system. But we think that if you look at the figures of attacks on Phun Sen Pek, and this, as I say, we took this rather drastic move when the attacks got so great in terms of the killings and the attacks on officers that we just didn't see how we were going to have an election if this continued. I think that's what persuaded Akashi finally that we could take such a drastic move. Yes, it had a deterrent effect in our view in terms of the reduction of those sort of atrocities, but it didn't stop them all, of course.
Mm-hmm. But there was no judiciary in which the three arrested people could be tried, was there?
Well, there was a judiciary, but none of the judges, when we approached them, were willing to make the trials. The only thing they were willing to do was to release them, even though one of the detainees was a Khmer Rouge killer who we had also apprehended. So no judge was willing or able to take those steps, and therefore they stayed in that terrible limbo situation throughout UNTAG's period.
The whole time?
The whole time. Well, but this was only instituted, from memory, probably in early 93.
I think that's right.
Right.
From what I've read.
Yes, I think it was signed into force in December 92 and instituted in early 93.
Now, going back to the question of pressure, in this case from the SOC, did your personnel come under any threats from the government in Phnom Penh?
I think the main ones who were exposed most, frankly, were our local staff.
Mm-hmm.
We had very loyal, trusted Cambodian interpreters, of course, who were in on all of the interviews, who helped us in the raids we made on prisons, who interviewed the victims of atrocities, And they were very, very afraid, in fact asked to be taken out of the country when we left, mm-hmm. and to be resettled in third countries, because they were very, very afraid for their lives from the SOC authorities.
And was that done?
In one case the person was taken out, and the other two, no, eventually I think they were not. Mm-hmm. But we certainly made all arrangements we possibly could to make sure that they were not victimized, and as far as I know they were not victimized. For the international stuff, and I'd say the local NGOs also ran some risks as well, and were very afraid at the start, and certainly asked for our protection, the Cambodian NGOs that we worked with in human rights. International staff generally were not threatened, although I was also myself had a message from the Minister of National Security at one stage that I should not leave Phnom Penh without his personal escort for my own safety. So you can read that as you wish. And I did get some hate mail when we strongly protested and tried to protect the Vietnamese who were being attacked in Cambodia.
Now, can you talk a little bit about the Vietnamese problem? You saw that, the intimidation or whatever else of the Vietnamese, as within the mandate of your office.
Oh yes, these were long-term residents. They were effectively Cambodians of Vietnamese ethnic origin. They had no longer Vietnamese papers or right to reside. And they were the subject of strong racist attacks. I'm afraid we had problems even convincing our Cambodian human rights organizations that Vietnamese were a legitimate area for protection. They were certainly entitled to be treated as, if not citizens, permanent residents of Cambodia. And they were massacred. They were massacred in large numbers by the Khmer Rouge in particular. But without any of the factions, either SOC or Phuong Son Pek or KPNLF, being willing to raise any voice in defense of them. That was a major, major concern.
What was your main means of defending them?
Well, we tried to investigate and follow up on the attacks when they occurred. Mm-hmm. We did have military and police involvement in those investigations to identify the, in some cases we identified the Khmer Rouge units who were concerned. We tried to get military patrols on the lake where the Vietnamese were in these floating fishing villages. There we had a major disagreement with our military friends, who really just didn't see themselves getting involved in that process at all. I would say there's a general passivity amongst most of the police military components on the Vietnamese issue, because as you know it was such a hot issue also politically. The Vietnamization of Cambodia was one of the political footballs. We took steps, not we, but our legal officer, Mr. Akashi's office, took steps to have alleged Vietnamese military expelled from Cambodia in order to pacify some of that feeling. So it was very sensitive, very tense, but it was certainly a basic human rights concern where we didn't have very much support, I must say.
Mm-hmm. But do you think you were able to accomplish something?
We certainly raised the profile of the issue. Mm-hmm. Whether one can, hard to measure accomplishments in these areas. There was one terrible massacre of more than 30 people from memory on Tonle Sap, where I certainly personally was involved in investigating with international press, and I think the coverage of people like William Shawcross and Henry Cam from the New York Times at that time were factors in making, at least raising the awareness that this group were being targeted yet again, as they had been historically. In Long Nol's time and before, they have been targeted in Cambodia.
Now, I want to go back to something you were saying about the way you were promoting human rights, because there, I've seen one of the films that was made on it. There were innovative ways, the puppet shows and so forth and so on. Who developed those? How did you get those ideas?
We had in my component a section which was just charged with that, how to get this message out in simple, understandable terms in a very short time period to a semi-literate or uneducated population which didn't have a tradition or a culture in this area. That was a major challenge. And we took on some Khmer advisors. We took advice from the Khmer NGOs. And I think we quickly understood that we had to be innovative and try and tap popular, culturally appropriate means, which I think, from memory, the Paris Accords also talked about.
Yes.
I'm not sure of the phrase now. I think it was culturally appropriate or something like to that. Where we realized in the human rights area, if we're going to succeed, we had to get the message through in that way. So we did those, as you say, rather innovative things, I think, because we couldn't use the normal means of communication. And I'd say UNCTAD radio which is mainly for the elections, is also pretty important in that context, getting those messages through, having the plays. And we did some television plays with Khmer actors in Khmer about rights as well. In fact, they obviously got close to the point because some of them, in fact, were eventually blocked by the SOC authorities.
I'd like to now move to the NGOs. If there are two parts really to the question. First, I believe that quite a large number of indigenous NGOs were formed. What was the role of UNTAG in that, in the development of what we now call civil society?
Well, there were virtually no Cambodian NGOs in the early 90s in existence. It was not a tradition.
Yeah.
It's part of this non-questioning of authority that I've mentioned, I think. It was not a role. Civil society in that sense didn't really exist. It started to exist when some expatriate Cambodians came back. Before or during the peace process. But in terms of human rights NGOs, I think two of them had just started during UNAMIR's time. During UNAMIR time. And we picked them up early on. That was, Lee Ka Do and Trun Sarai's group. And what we did was basically try to advise them on structuring their organization. We eventually gave $50,000 cash grant and administrative support to each human rights NGO, including those two and two or three new ones which were formed during our period, which we encouraged the formation of. We gave training courses in Khmer. We brought the monks in to try and spread the message. What we didn't give them was physical protection, and we couldn't. And I remember at the start that some of them begged for that because they were very afraid. But I must say they gradually got more confidence, and we would meet with them on a regular basis. I had one of my colleagues did nothing else but liaise with them, my Asian colleague liaising with them, and eventually we funded and bought in a consortium, as I mentioned, of other Asian NGOs, led by a very able Sri Lankan person who'd been through similar conflicts and who were able also to give advice as Asians to the Cambodian groups. We took the leaders of the Cambodian groups to Bangkok, to the Human Rights Commission session in Geneva. We exposed them as much as we could to the broader human rights dimension. But it was a difficult process. They were factionalized. They were generally anti-Vietnamese, which was a problem. It was a problem to get them often to sit together. It's still a problem. I've been back to Cambodia last year, and some of the same tensions still exist, I'm afraid, between them. I think symptomatic of society at large, perhaps. Some of them have subsequently complained and been quoted as saying that we didn't understand them enough. We were too foreign, Western imposed. You might have seen some of that. Those comments that we came there and tried to transfer values, etc. I think that's a little unfair when I reflect on just how much in disarray and how much uncertainty there was at the outset. And the fact is that since that time they have all survived and in fact flourished by and large. And if there's any legacy out of the human rights area that's tangible, it's probably in a way the Cambodian human rights groups, which continue to function. But it wasn't easy, and I would say the other thing that I discovered there, or rediscovered there in Cambodia, was that there are virtually no international operational human rights NGOs. There are international advocacy human rights groups. Human Rights Watch, Amnesty International, etc., come in, make reports, and leave. But we were desperate to get operational human rights people on the ground. And that is a gap in the international setup, in my view. Hence the consortium that we helped to establish of Asian NGOs. And we brought in people like International Commission of Jurists, International Law Group. We paid for trainers to come from those groups to train judges, to run a training course in the medical school, in the law school, etc. But there's a real dearth, a gap in the international structures for this sort of civil society promotion. It's talked about a lot, but in the human rights area, there are very few experienced operational bodies available.
And you mentioned the international human rights organizations that come and look and go.
Hmm.
Could you describe your relations with them, and how did you react to the criticism that they frequently expressed of the operation in Cambodia?
The criticism that I was aware of was not so much expressed to the human rights component. I don't know what you've seen, but as I recall, the criticism was more about the failure of UNTAC generally to deal with some of the basic issues and to take firm stands and publicize on certain things. We had a number of discussions with them. We even sponsored one or two conferences with Ford Foundation support, bringing international NGOs, Human Rights Watch, Amnesty and others around the table with the Cambodians and the regional groups in order to discuss the sort of problems that were being faced. By and large, with one notable exception perhaps, the criticisms I think were directed at UNTAG's overall focus, the failure to take a stand on the Khmer Rouge, etc.
And some of them suggested, I believe, that there was a tendency to marginalize the human rights activities.
Yes, that's what I mean. It was directed at UNTAG, I think. And I think that criticism is not all unfair. Certainly in the human rights component, we felt a degree of marginalization, as I mentioned at the outset, especially as the political imperatives for an election at just about, not I shouldn't say at any cost, but at a pretty high cost. The thresholds were certainly raised, if you like, or lowered, if you put it that way, as we approached the need to have that election. Sure.
Now, going to a different subject, the Thais. You had experience with the Thais, obviously, before you went to Cambodia.
Mm-hmm.
But
for many years.
The camps were a problem, as I understand it, for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
Did your mandate, Cambodian mandate, extend to the condition of Cambodians in the camps that was actually in Thailand?
No. The human rights mandate didn't extend outside Cambodia. That remained the responsibility of UMBRO for the border camps and UNHCR for the UNHCR camps. And eventually, of course, UNHCR took over and organized the repatriation with my friend Sergio Vieira de Mello heading that component, organized that repatriation of 370,000 people from the border. Human rights was, as I mentioned to you, the sort of infant program that we started with UMBRO on the border. A collaboration, not a very extensive one, but a collaboration on monitoring the rights of returnees once they'd come back inside. And I did do one cross-border visit with Sergio Vieira de Mello where we addressed the border NGOs to tell them that in our joint opinion they should not be resistant to the repatriation, which some of them were, and that the basic conditions in the areas the returnees were going to were monitored by us and were satisfactory for return.
They were, because a specific question there, some of the literature I've read suggests that the various factions, the Khmer Rouge, the Phnom Penh group, each had certain camps in their control and did try to persuade or even force the refugees to go back before the conditions were ready.
Well, the camps were all in the hands of the factions, which excluded Phnom Penh.
Yeah.
So there were Khmer Rouge camps, there were Phun Sen Pek camps, and there were Son San or KPNLF camps, yes. And they were, to some extent, captive populations. The most captive, of course, was the Khmer Rouge. But the others were not exactly models of freedom either. Certainly the Khmer Rouge leaders wanted the people to go back to their areas. Although that didn't necessarily happen in the event, that was certainly their inclination. The others, by and large, didn't have the same imperative because they had their people already in Phnom Penh, for example, which the Khmer Rouge didn't. The problem for the rest was essentially that the areas they came from more or less were mined or dangerous. And what made the repatriation work was that UNHCR gave up on returning people to their land and gave them cash options instead. And that's how they really got them to come back.
But you didn't feel that there was an infringement in human rights in that people were being more or less forced to come back before conditions were ready?
They wanted to come back. They wanted to come back. They, in fact, queued up. We couldn't, UNHCR couldn't handle the queue to come back once it started. They wanted to come back for the elections. They wanted to come back to see if they could get their land. They wanted to cash in on the economic opportunities. There was no resistance to coming back, except for a handful. And those 300 or so at the end, we did a joint screening with UNHCR, did a screening of them to ascertain that none of those 300 or 400, as I remember it, individuals, had an individual fear that justified them staying out of the country. And that was done quite carefully by UNHCR protection people, and they were also cleared for return. So no, I don't think so. I think once the momentum started, they wanted to come. They'd also been fed up. They'd been on that terrible border for a decade or more, many of them. So once it started, they did come. It wasn't ideal. It wasn't as it should have been. And maybe some of them are in the new exodus that have gone out again, of course.
A different kind of question. Mm-hmm. I think it's time.
That's all right.
The decision was made in Cambodia by UNTAC not to try forcefully to disarm the Khmer Rouge. What were your views on that? What part did you take in that decision? And how did your staff feel about that?
Well, I took no part in the decision.
No part.
That was a decision essentially between Mr. Akashi, General Sanderson, in collaboration with New York. It was a very hard question. I think disarming the Khmer Rouge was a tall order. But before we got to that, there was a famous incident in April 92, which you may have heard of, in Pailin, where Mr. Akashi, General Sanderson, was stopped by a bamboo pole and a few Khmer Rouge soldiers from proceeding into the Khmer Rouge area. Many of us felt very strongly that that was a turning point, that UNTAC had to show its teeth a little and go on ahead despite a bamboo pole and a couple of rather nervous soldiers, or else there wasn't much point in having 15,000 soldiers and 2,500, 3,000 police there in a peacekeeping operation. That decision was taken, however, not to proceed. And from that time on, and with some of the apparently unbalanced aid being given to Hun Sen and Sok, and not equal distribution to the factions, very soon after that, the Khmer Rouge pulled out of the entire process, refused to participate. And once that happened, of course, there was no question of disarming 10 or 15,000 jungle fighters scattered around those mountainous jungles of the edges of Cambodia. And they're still there, some of them. So I'm not sure it's so much a question of just disarming, it's a question of taking a consistent, firm, clear position on the whole role of UNTAC vis-a-vis the Khmer Rouge. I think one of the things that came out very loudly was neither perhaps New York, the Security Council, but particularly the donor contributing countries had any stomach for engaging Khmer Rouge. They were all very afraid, and so were the senior military officials, of losses in such an engagement. And of course it was a Chapter 6 operation, or 6.5 we used to call it, but nevertheless that held back a lot of the initiatives that could be taken. We had vehicles stolen by them, driven openly in front of us, and our military contingents did nothing about it. We had soldiers disarmed forcibly by them. There's very little reaction taken to some of the excesses of the Khmer Rouge. And I think gradually we lost our credibility vis-a-vis them. And of course, just to finish that, their failure to come in and disarm meant that Sok had every reason not to disarm also. And once Sok didn't disarm, we effectively didn't have a key part of the peace agreement in place.
I'm going to stop.
Yeah, you might need to change that.
Turn it over.
Yeah.
Seems to be.